Welcome to Do Better Research, a learning-focused podcast about research methods. I'm Dr. Suzanne Aubrey, and I'll be speaking to a range of guests to help guide you through different research methods to become a better researcher, both for academic study and professional practice. In this episode, I talk to Dr. Christopher Huggins, the Associate Dean for Learning, Teaching and Student Experience and Associate Professor in Politics at the University of Suffolk. Chris is a mixed methods researcher whose profile focuses on subnational politics in Europe and the UK's withdrawal from the European Union. In our interview, we talk about accessible quantitative and secondary research with a focus on his published short article entitled, Did EU Regional Spending Affect the Brexit Referendum? Chris, thank you very much for joining me on the Do Better Research podcast. It's fantastic to have you here, and I'm particularly excited about to talk to you about the paper you sent to me, which is about quantitative research, which, as any listener from this podcast will know, I am atrocious at and terrified of. But before we get into that, I would like to ask you a question that I ask all of my guests on this podcast, which is, what do you enjoy about doing research?
So I'll say for context that I'm a political scientist, so I'm really interested in politics. But rather than politics itself, I'm interested in what makes politics tick, what makes it work, and what explains various sort of political decisions or outcomes that we see happen around the world. So I guess there's lots of aspects to that. But in terms of what I enjoy about research is what fundamentally explains the way politics works. You look at politics at the moment, there's lots of, you know, commentary you can say, well, why on earth is this happening? What made Brexit happen? Why on earth is the government doing this? It seems to defy all sorts of logic. And there's lots of these sort of questions that abound, I guess, in media, and you see them on social media all the time. And so fundamentally, I really enjoy doing political research because I like getting to the bottom of those questions. And as is the case with anything in politics, the answer is normally very complex. So I find it really enjoyable to find out about some of these complexities. And I guess at the root of all political research is the question of power. Yeah. So who's got power? How is that power used? What are maybe some of the hidden ways that power operates? And it's those sort of questions I really like delving into. And I like to think my political research allows me to sort of unpick some of these things. Obviously, I can never do everything I perhaps want, but I get great satisfaction out of just, you know, trying to understand what's going on in the world and using research as a way to figure that out for myself rather than having to rely on what other people tell me.
And that's really about understanding cultural contexts as well, isn't it? Not just about politics and policies, but how they're influenced and influence other things.
Yeah, and I love politics as a field of study because it encompasses a bit of everything. So, you know, you can't look at politics without having an appreciation of history, for example. You can't look at politics without thinking about some of the, you know, debates in philosophy, for example, and you know, that tell us about human behaviour and such. And there's lots of other links to things like psychology, geography, and economics, for example. So, you know, politics for me is one of these disciplines that does have all these links to various cultural issues, things like law, history, and, you know, it's a place where all these things come together. And if you do research in this field, often you have to look at all these different angles and aspects on things to try and unpick what's going on.
I really love the interdisciplinary nature of that kind of research. I think it's really important not to see different research disciplines in isolation, to have that cross-section of them.
Yeah, there's lots of disciplines like that. I mean, obviously, I'm interested in politics, but I think there's loads of different disciplines that are like that. One of the recent projects I've been working on is looking at how fisheries policy is going to be governed after Brexit. And that's another really good example about how things are inherently interdisciplinary. So you can't do a research project like that unless you're willing to talk to marine scientists and marine biologists and stuff and understand about conservation of the sea. But equally, you can't do something like that without having a grounding in international law. And you can't look at this area unless you have some sort of understanding about, you know, the cultural significance of the fishing industry to the UK. So there are lots of these sort of nice overlaps that I really like to unpick. And obviously the depth of some of these overlaps is, you know, can be overwhelming sometimes, and often it means you can only look at one or two different angles. But that also, I think, provides nice opportunities to work with others who perhaps are specialists in some of these areas. So, you know, through the fisheries research I've done, I've built up links with, you know, environmental scientists, for example, that normally you wouldn't do. And, you know, that's been really enriching, I think, to, you know, try and understand fundamentally what's going on.
I love the idea that drives a kind of a collaborative relationship with other researchers. And, you know, the acknowledgement that other people are going to have research areas and skills and expertise that you don't, and that allows the opportunity to work together.
Yeah. And, you know, I find that great. You know, I don't think it's really possible now, you know, nowadays to do the sort of important research that society requires, unless you sort of do take this, you know, multidisciplinary approach and draw on the expertise of lots of people. You know, I don't think we live in an age where, you know, there's like the single polymath who can, you know, figure everything out. I think we sort of have to rely on what other people tell us, what other people's skills are, what other people's subject knowledge is, because it's, you know, actually it's incredibly difficult. My area of politics is relatively niche. I'm interested in something called multi-level governance. So, you know, the different dynamics between different levels of government and how different levels of government, whether they be at the international level or the local level, interact with each other. That's quite niche. And because of that, I don't really have the expertise to look at other areas of politics, say, you know, areas around political theory and, you know, the grand debates about what is right and wrong in politics. So, you know, I've got some of my own personal perceptions about that, and I have some awareness of the debates, but I don't, say, have the expertise of a political theorist. So, you know, I think in a lot of the research we do in politics, but, you know, I guess the social sciences more broadly, there's loads of opportunities, I think, to, you know, bring people together and, you know, answer some of these big questions that are out there.
And that leads me really nicely onto my second question, which is, what has been your favourite piece of research that you've done so far, and why?
So that's a hard question to answer, because I've done lots of little projects that I really like. So I'm going to give you three answers, if that's allowed.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the first, I guess, one of the favourite pieces of the research I did is the stuff I did for my PhD. And obviously I got a PhD out of it, so I'm very happy about it. And it has a place dear in my heart. But it also, you know, as you'd expect a PhD to do, it, you know, sort of kick-started my academic research career anyway. My PhD looked at how local government in England and France was directly interacting with the European Union. So again, it fitted that mould of, you know, the sort of multi-level governance, this idea of the different relationships between different levels of government. But it was fundamentally interested in how local authorities in one country link up with local authorities in other countries, and how they do that in the setting of the European Union, and, you know, asking the question, well, why are they doing this? Why, you know, why are the people who go around and pick up the bins, like setting up offices in Brussels and talking to local authorities in France and Italy, why would you do that? So, you know, I sort of started with that puzzle, and that puzzle came out of my career before I came into academia, which was actually working in local government and being a policy officer of local government. And I once met this person who worked in the council called the European Officer, and I thought that sounded interesting. What was all that about? So, you know, it all came about this question about, well, why, you know, traditionally you might think of government as being this nice hierarchical system, but actually you do a bit of digging and you figure out it's much more complicated than that. And I really wanted to do this project to, you know, to figure out what on earth was going on. And there weren't at the time a lot of people doing a lot of research on this. Some people had done some stuff in the 1990s, but, you know, when I was doing it, early 2000s, not a lot of people had really done much about it. So, you know, essentially I thought, okay, let's see what we can find out. And I started the PhD in, I think it was 12 years ago I started my PhD, and, you know, it was brilliant. I got to do a bit of travel for it. So, you know, talking to people who worked in local government across England and across France, and then, you know, doing interviews in Brussels and stuff as well. So, you know, that was quite nice as well, just to get out there and talk to people who work in, I guess, a professional setting and find out about their perceptions about things. So that, I think, was my first favourite research project. The second, I guess, favourite research project was around the one I'm sort of still wrapping up at the moment, really, which is around Brexit and fisheries governance. So fisheries policy took on this rather strange high profile during the whole Brexit debate. You know, it's a minuscule part of the UK economy overall. There's important questions about, well, why? Why does something that is such a tiny part of the economy become such a significant political issue? But our research project focused primarily on the issue of devolution. So again, it fitted with this theme of government across multiple levels and about some of the complexities that would happen about the relationship between governments in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, for example, maybe wanting to pursue their own agenda against the UK government wanting to pursue its own agenda against a wider negotiation that was going on at the time with the European Union about, you know, fisheries access and alignment of policies and all the rest of it. And that project was really fascinating to me because, you know, fisheries policy is something I didn't really know anything about. So, you know, I knew a lot about devolution and, you know, multi-level governance. That was my field of expertise. But I knew absolutely nothing about fisheries policy other than the fact that, you know, it seemed to be quite important in Brexit. So it was a good opportunity, I guess, to sort of, you know, learn something new about that field of policy. And I think the other thing I enjoyed about the project was just the links I made doing that project, not only with other political scientists across the UK. So it was attached to a prestigious ESRC grant, which, you know, is always nice to have. But, you know, that in itself opened up opportunities to engage as part of a wider research network. So the grant was managed through this organisation called UK in a Changing Europe, who do absolutely fantastic work. They're funded by the ESRC. And they do fantastic work trying to inform public knowledge about the relationship between the UK and the European Union. So, you know, I got to link up with other people who are working on other projects that the UK and the Changing Europe were doing, from everything around, you know, public opinion during the Brexit referendum to the impact of Brexit on the environment, the impact of Brexit on manufacturing. You know, I really got a lot of insight, you know, just linking up. Even in relatively, not even in necessarily a detailed way, but you get to learn a lot. And in terms of the project itself, you know, I got to link up with disciplines I thought I never would. So, you know, marine scientists and ecologists, international law experts, all of these, you know, sort of all these perspectives that I had never sort of formed part of my research before. It was actually just, you know, really nice to see what they had to say and realise that actually, even if you work in diverse fields, you've all got common research interests in some way, and you can, you know, you can gain an awful lot. And there have been some really good research collaborations that have come out from it. That was really the second project, one of my favourites. And then I guess the third research project is the one you alluded to in your opening around a recent article I published, which is around, you know, a piece of secondary data analysis. This was a really tiny, small scale project. But actually, it was another one of these that was prompted by one of these puzzling questions that often comes up in politics. And this all came about after the Brexit referendum and the result. And I went as part of this. I was invited to go on this sort of masterclass for early career researchers run by the Regional Studies Association. And they run this masterclass in Brussels, as part of this annual event called the European Week of Regions and Cities. So I was invited, along with a few other sort of early career scholars from across Europe, to sort of take part in this masterclass, which in and of itself was a fantastic opportunity, and I'm really glad I had. But we got to go to this opening event, and there was a European Commissioner for Regional Policy. And this was relatively recently after the referendum. I can't exactly remember when it was, but we're talking just a couple of months after, I suspect. And we went to this sort of opening session with lots of people there in the European Parliament, where the European Commissioner for Regional Policy said, why did somewhere like Wales vote to leave? We have literally thrown billions of euros at the regions that all voted to leave. So, you know, why is it the regions that we've invested most heavily in, why did they vote to leave? And, you know, it's that to me raised a really interesting question. So, actually, that is a good question, because, you know, your traditional perception of like rational politics is, you know, if you meet voter demands, so, you know, you invest more in local areas, then those voters are more likely to support you. But, you know, anecdotally, at least, the referendum result seems to have sort of, that result didn't seem to have come through. In fact, it almost seems to have had the opposite effect, where putting more money in to some of these areas seems to have actually weakened support for the European Union. So I guess that sort of posed a puzzle for me. And I was really interested then in saying, OK, well, does this hold true? Is this just some sort of anecdotal piece of evidence? Or actually, is there something in this puzzle? Is it the case that areas that had more investment were more likely to vote Leave? It was a nice sort of project I could do. And it really didn't take that much time either, because a lot of the data already existed. So I didn't have to go out there and, you know, do my own surveys, do my own data collection. It was stuff that already existed. It required a bit of work to tidy up the data and stuff. But other than that, it was a relatively nice piece of work I could just sort of crack on with and get done and sort of answer my own question that had been sort of, you know, an idea that had been sparked myself, and I was able to sort of, you know, see it through. And I was able to sort of conclude it pretty quickly as well. And it was just a really nice little fun project to do. It wasn't tied to any sort of personal research development plan I had. It wasn't tied to any sort of research agenda I was particularly doing. It was just a fun little project I could do, and, you know, it sparked a piece of interest.
I mean, that's really interesting. And having read the article, it answers a really interesting question. Mm-hmm. And just the idea of this person standing up and saying, but we've given all this money, why do they reject the premise that we're from, kind of thing? Which poses a really interesting cultural question as well.
Yeah, it poses a really interesting cultural question, but it in the context, I think, of European Union politics, it actually poses a lot of other really important questions as well. Mm. So, you know, it poses a question about the effectiveness of policy. You know, if you're throwing billions of euros at a particular region and it's not having any discernible impact on what people think, is that an effective use of that money? It poses some important policy questions, I think, as well. And, you know, there have been wider debates within the European studies literature around the effectiveness of the European Union in certain areas. So, it nicely fits into some of that stuff as well.
And you said that you used secondary data. So one of the questions that I get a lot from students, actually, is, will my research project be as good from using secondary data? And I think there is a very much perception amongst researchers that primary data is the best kind of data to collect for research. But you've used secondary data here. So what are some of the benefits of using secondary data rather than going to the effort of collecting your own?
Yeah, so in terms of that question, I think, you know, I personally dispel them if I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. So I don't think either secondary data or primary data have particular inherent advantages or disadvantages that means either is better than the other. I think they serve different purposes, and I think that this ultimately comes back to, you know, what does make a good, important piece of research is not necessarily, well, obviously the data actually, you know, is an important aspect of that, and, you know, how robust it is and everything. But, you know, fundamentally what you need at the heart of all research projects is a question that can be answered, and it has to be a relevant question. It has to be something that contributes to knowledge, be that in a small way or profound way or whatever. So I don't think there's necessarily something inherently better about primary data. I don't think there's something necessarily better about secondary data. It's just they serve different purposes. So if your starting point is always your research question, then some research questions will require you to have primary data, just by the very nature of the fact that actually the data you might need to answer your question might not exist. So you will need to go out and get it. Or maybe the data that does exist is too dated to give you a contemporary take on it. So again, you'll need to go out there and gather your own data. But, you know, there are a whole range of other research questions out there which actually can be answered by looking at existing data. And more often than not, a lot of these questions are answered by combining different data sets. So you're looking at data that's been gathered for a particular purpose, but actually, you know, there's some element of synthesis that can take place in this. So this project, for example, looked at two pieces of data, and this is data that wasn't actually gathered for research. So one of the data sets was simply the referendum results in the UK broken down by local authority. So, you know, that was just looking at how many in each local authority area, how many people voted leave, how many people voted remain. That wasn't gathered for any particular piece of research. That was just, you know, the Electoral Commission doing what it normally does, gathering information about national votes and publishing the data online. And then the second data set was how much money had been invested in individual European regions. And, you know, these almost, not quite, but almost nicely mapped onto local authority boundaries. And, you know, again, that wasn't produced for a particular research project. It was produced for, I guess, an internal reporting mechanism for the European Union, just to see how much money was being spent where. So, you know, a lot of the case in secondary data research, you're actually employing data that isn't gathered for the purpose of academic research. It's gathered for other purposes, but you can still use it and sometimes synthesize different data sets to answer some of these interesting questions.
And that doesn't necessarily make the data less reliable.
No, it doesn't make it less reliable. The challenge with secondary data is you've got to do a lot of sorting and cleaning of it out. So the biggest job I had to do in this project was the election results were, or the referendum results were reported at the local authority level. Yeah. So imagine the country split up into different territorial units, and those boundaries correspond to different local authorities. So, you know, that's how the referendum result was reported. And the EU reported its spending based on what are called NUTS 3 regions. And the boundaries almost exactly match those of the local authorities. However, a couple of these NUTS-free regions don't quite map onto local authorities. So I had to do a bit of sort of, you know, sorting of the data, just, you know, checking where the areas overlapped and where they didn't overlap and trying to sort that out. So with any piece of secondary data research, you need to do a bit of, I guess, evaluation of the data sets that you're using. You need to look at the quality of the data. You need to make sure that, you know, if you are combining data sets, you can be confident that where you're sort of, you're using a common key between different data records, it's, you know, that will nicely tessellate together, as it were. So you spend a lot of time in secondary data research doing a lot of this sort of background data cleaning and data sorting stuff. And you know, this has got a lot easier because, you know, there are some fantastic tools out there now that can help you do that. But that requires a fair bit of work. Whereas, you know, if you're doing primary data research, actually you don't need to do as much of that data sorting work because you're designing your data collection around what you want to get out of it in the first place. So, you know, what you save a lot of this data sorting time because you'll obviously be designing, let's say you're doing a survey, you'll be designing your survey instrument to give you the sort of data that you need. Obviously, the trade-off then is you've got to go out and spend time gathering your own data. So, you know, there's, as with all research methods, there's an element of trade-off depending on what you want to do. So, yeah, there was a bit of time spent on, you know, this sort of data sorting, I guess. But the data was readily accessible. It was very easy to get hold of. You just go on a website and you download it as like an Excel file. And then you just, you know, you look through it and you just make sure that, you know, you sort of have to put it in the right format and stuff so you can merge it together. But once you've done that, you're ready to go, basically.
So this is a piece of research that you've done is very much quantitative research.
Yeah.
And I hear the word quantitative research and I think lots of numbers, there's going to be some SPSS magic that happens and I'll have no idea what the numbers end up telling me.
Yeah.
But this doesn't seem like it's that difficult to understand. I've, you know, having read the article, having looked at the data sets and the information you've presented, it doesn't feel like it went through that process.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it went through the exact same process you would with any other quantitative research project. So, you know, there's an element of, you know, running a statistical analysis on the data, so there is a statistical analysis within there. But actually for this project, the statistical analysis I needed to do wasn't particularly anything fancy. There's sometimes a tendency in some quantitative research to overdo the statistical analysis when actually, you know, I use what are relatively simple tools, basic correlation analysis, and then sort of simple, you know, what's known as a linear regression. So, you know, this is relatively basic stuff that shouldn't put too much people off, and actually isn't that much, if you haven't been introduced to quantitative research before, it isn't actually that difficult to pick up, and, you know, you can do online courses on this sort of stuff and everything. And actually the predominance of analysis that I used for this, I learned on the job when I was a market research analyst for a local authority. So, you know, these are tools and techniques I applied, not having learned them in an academic context. I learned them on the job when I worked in local government, for example. I think part of this, you know, you say it's easy to understand the story. And I think part of this is, you know, down to good reporting. You know, that sounds a bit trumpeting my own trumpet, as it were. But, you know, part of this is down to how well we communicate our research, I think, more than anything. You know, obviously you need to show the statistical analysis you're doing so people can be confident that your results are legitimate and robust and valid. But actually, part of this is, you know, just writing a load of numbers is all good and well, but part of our job of researchers is to actually do some interpretation of the analysis. And actually that's where the researcher comes in. It's to interpret the statistical analysis. I mean, yeah, you can get a computer to do the analysis for you. And in some ways you don't necessarily even need to write things like articles or report your results. The sort of real meat of the substance comes in how you write it up and how you interpret what you find and how you link that to wider debates. So, you know, my overall message would be the analysis in here isn't particularly advanced. You know, it's relatively basic stuff. This is stuff we teach our undergraduates, for example, our first year undergraduate students. I could probably give this project, having sorted the data, to, you know, this would make a really nice dissertation project actually for a third year undergraduate. So it's not particularly advanced stuff from a research point of view. But I think this highlights actually the versatility of some quantitative approaches, which is you can achieve a lot with relatively simple approaches, and you can tell some really interesting stories and answer some interesting questions without having to engage in a massive piece of analysis. Obviously, there's quantitative research out there in the world that you know will go completely to town on some stuff, and you know I perhaps could have done more with this if I wanted to delve a bit deeper in this article. If I wanted to explore this further, I could have done even more, you know, fancy analysis and all the rest of it. But ultimately, it was just enough really to do the analysis I did.
I really love what you said there about telling the story and making sure that we're communicating effectively, because any way that we report research is about the story, yeah. It's about the narrative that we're telling. And I think that's making it accessible is part of the challenge we have as researchers.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this has really been drummed home to me on my recent research project is actually, you know, which has looked at Brexit, is actually as researchers, I do think, obviously, we've got sort of obligation to report our results to the academic community. That's why we publish. But, you know, I do think we have some sort of wider responsibility. If the purpose of research is to, you know, inform societal debate, I don't really subscribe to the view that research is just there for research's sake. It's more that, you know, we're supposed to have some sort of impact, and that impact can be anything, but it, there has to be some sort of impact. And, you know, impact might be, for example, you want to evaluate government policy, or you want to inform societal debate on something, or you want to understand the past or something like that. So, you know, I think we have some sort of obligation as researchers to communicate our findings. And, you know, I wrote a blog post which this accompanied, you know, in an attempt to do that. And again, you know, that blog post doesn't actually report the stats. It just focuses on the story that perhaps is of more interest to the general public. And, you know, that got some that got some interest on social media and stuff, you know, which is nice. So I think this telling the story aspect is really important, not only in terms of how we report research in an academic context, but more widely as well.
With that in mind, and the idea of telling the story, what did the piece of research conclude?
Overall, the piece of research concluded that actually EU spending had very little effect on the way different regions voted. So, you know, although we started off with this puzzle saying, why did all the regions that had the most money vote to leave? Actually, the overall impact wasn't perhaps as profound once you, what we call in quantitative terms, once you control for other things. So we knew from existing research on the Brexit vote, which came up very quickly, that some demographic factors around age, education, social class, for example, were really important factors. And we knew issues around social attitudes were also interesting in the way people voted. So once you accounted for those things, actually you find that there isn't really much of a link between how much money a particular region got from the European Union and how that region voted. The statistical analysis shows, you know, if you really want to go into detail, the statistical analysis shows a minuscule positive impact, showing that, you know, once you start investing loads and loads of money, you actually start to have a positive impact on the way people may vote, in terms of the more money you throw in, the more likely that region is to vote to stay in the EU. But by that point, you're investing billions to get a few percentage points gain. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the overall conclusion of the article is that the amount of regional spending local areas got in the EU referendum had relatively little impact on how they voted. And that then, I guess, poses more questions, as any good research project normally would do. So, you know, the question then is, well, has the EU been wasting its time in investing money in these regions? Or has the EU done a poor job of communicating what it's been doing to these regions? So, you know, it in some ways it opened up additional questions for future research.
As you said, as all good research should, really.
Yes.
So one of the other things that I just wanted to ask, and this is based on the format of the article, and as I said, I'm going to put the link to the article because it is open access in the show notes. And this is particularly for early career researchers and early career academics. The article is called a short article.
Yeah.
What is the difference between a short article and a normal, whatever normal looks like, journal article?
So I think this is still, I guess, a full journal article, but it's in a slightly smaller format. And there are a number of reasons for that. This is submitted to a journal which you know, likes to have research that packs a punch, basically. So it gets across a simple idea really effectively and as quickly as possible. So I don't think there's necessarily any difference between a full article, other than, you know, say if I'd added another dimension to this, if the title of the article was why, if I added a why to the question of the article, then it would probably be a longer article that incorporated more discussion and stuff. Mm-hmm. But really the purpose of the article was relatively exploratory. It took that puzzle that I mentioned right at the start and just wanted to see if that, you know, anecdotally we've heard that certain regions voted to leave and they were the regions that had the most money invested in them. Well, is that true? So it was a relatively exploratory analysis. So it wasn't particularly in depth in terms of, you know, it wasn't trying to answer like a PhD level kind of analysis. It was just a relatively short project, and you can write these things up in a relatively short amount of time. In terms of the structure of the article itself, the structure pretty much rigidly follows your standard approach to reporting quantitative research. So, you know, you've got an introduction that will be followed by a form of literature review, which assesses the field. You've got a section on your research design and your data. You report your results and then you discuss them and you have conclusions. So, you know, this is the standard sort of format for any quantitative research article, really. And, you know, quantitative studies that are much more in depth will follow exactly the same structure, but obviously may include multiple hypotheses, or they may include multiple research questions within them. So, you know, would obviously be longer.
That's really useful. Thank you. I realise that question might have put you on the spot a little bit, but I think it's one of those things that if you don't know the academic journal market and what different options there are in publishing, particularly, it's just really useful to get a quick highlight about what do these terms mean.
Yeah, and it is important to point out the article was published, you know, via a scheme that one of the associations I'm a member of, the Regional Studies Association, had running for relatively early career researchers to publish like, you know, quick, impactful articles, you know, that were relatively short. So, you know, this was, I guess, submitted under a particular scheme, and lots of different journals have these different schemes in place, or they look for particular articles that are sometimes shorter than the norm, or they look for articles that make a quick and relevant policy contribution. So part of what this article was trying to do was, you know, make a relatively swift intervention in a wider debate that was going on.
That's fantastic. So thank you very much, Chris. Is there anything else you would like to say about anything we've talked about?
I think the main message would be around, in terms of thinking about quantitative research, is there's often this perception that it's really difficult to do. But it's a skill in the same way that doing qualitative research is. So, you know, if I'm a qualitative researcher who specialises in doing semi-structured interviews, for example, well, there is a skill to organising, conducting the interviews, analysing interview data. And really, that's no different from the skills in going out there and gathering quantitative data and analysing that data. So, you know, it's a skill like any other. And I think the numbers can sometimes put people off, but my view is, you know, having, you know, I am a mixed methods researcher, I do both, and my view is I find the quantitative research slightly easier, because I find qualitative research much harder to write up, because there's a lot more, I think, groundwork you have to do in terms of justifying your interpretation of the results, in reporting them, in making sure you give a voice to your participants and all of that sort of thing. Whereas, you know, it's in some ways it's that there are certain formulas, I guess, for reporting quantitative research that can make that side of things a bit easier. But, you know, it's down to personal preference and perception, I guess. So I know, you know, I know other mixed methods researchers who are much more interested in the qualitative side of things. I don't particularly have a preference either way, but I do find the reporting of quantitative research easier than the reporting of qualitative research.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Chris. I really appreciate that. That's been a really interesting discussion.
No problem at all.